I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There. This is a podcast about the outdoors, from your window box and garden, to the fields on the edge of town, to the forests, prairies, seashores, and wilderness. On the show, we explore our relationship with nature through stories, interviews, essays, and even some fiction. We travel around the U.S. and the world with tales of love and heartbreak, passion and adversity, desperation and triumph. On this episode, we're going to hear from a scientist who works in one of the least hospitable environments on Earth. Trista Vic Majors has spent 5 seasons conducting research in Antarctica. She wrote this piece about her team's quest to find out if there's life deep beneath the ice. Her story gives us a rare behind-the-scenes glimpse at what it's like to work in one of the most extreme places on the planet, a place so remote and unforgiving that failure seems imminent every step of the way.
I woke up to the muffled beeping of my alarm clock. It was that really fast beeping that happens when you ignore it for too long. I hadn't heard it through my minus 40 degree sleeping bag or through the earplugs I was wearing to drown the noise of the massive generators that ran day and night to power our hot water drill and camp equipment. I had been out cold for the past 4 hours, even though the inside of my tent was constantly bathed in a yellowish tinted light by the Antarctic summer sun. 36 hours ago, our team of hot water drillers had accomplished what none of us were sure was ever going to happen. They had melted a 16-inch diameter hole through the ice sheet that covers the continent of Antarctica. This opened the very first portal into another world, a shallow lake filled with brownish water buried beneath a half a mile of ice. From the time that borehole opened, we had only 96 hours to sample the water and mud of that shallow pond, which is called Subglacial Lake Willens. The clock was already ticking towards winter when the so-called polar night would make access impossible. In Antarctica, it's dark 24/7 in the winter. I reminded myself of that as I tried to shake off the grogginess. I looked at the time. 4 o'clock. Was that a.m. or p.m.? I really couldn't remember. 48 hours from then, we'd be celebrating with champagne, but all I knew at the time was that I had barely slept for 8 hours in the last 3 days. I was a third-year PhD student, and I was part of a team of 10 microbiologists camped out on the West Antarctic ice sheet. We came from 5 universities in 3 different countries, and we were part of a group of around 40 people, geophysicists, geologists, ice drillers, marine technicians, and camp support staff. Each of those people were either studying Subglacial Lake Willens or providing support for the science team. What we were doing there was looking for life. Life that we all suspected existed in the lake, buried deep beneath the ice, but that no one had ever seen. I joined the project in 2010, right after I finished my master's degree studying what happens to bacteria in Antarctic surface lakes as the sun set for the long polar night. I had spent the 2 intervening years planning experiments and formulating what would be the work of my doctoral dissertation on Subglacial Lake Willens. Is there life in this cold, dark lake? What does it look like? And, most intriguing to me, what does it eat down there? Antarctica is known for many things, including being the highest, driest, coldest, windiest continent in the world. 70% of the world's fresh water is locked within its vast expanse of ice. In places, that ice is nearly 3 miles thick and conceals entire mountain ranges. Since the explorers and adventurers of the early 20th century first battled its extreme weather, no one had really thought of Antarctica as a hospitable continent. And then, in 1957, the Russian Antarctic program built Vostok Station. Nearly a half a century later, it became clear that there, at the coldest place on Earth, Vostok was floating 2 miles above a massive lake. This subglacial lake was nearly the size of Lake Ontario and over 1,000 feet deep. Researchers quickly determined that there were trillions of gallons of icy cold water in it and the hundreds of other lakes that dotted the Antarctic. These lakes were buried deep beneath the Antarctic ice sheet. This presented a tantalizing possibility. Maybe there was life down there. After all, we generally assume that where there's water, there's life. And so, an entire community of exploration-minded scientists set out on a mission to find out if this held true in Antarctica, deep beneath the ice. The problem was getting to the water, and getting to it without mucking it up with chemicals and garbage like humans so often do. That took 20 years of preparation and international collaboration. 20 years of waiting. Just a week earlier, I too had been waiting at McMurdo Station, which is Antarctica's largest research base. A couple of months before that, my arrival at McMurdo had marked the end of 2 years of waiting to get the project started. Samples had never been collected from a subglacial lake before, and the path to success was something like finding an unmarked, unmaintained trail up a 14,000-foot mountain peak, without a map, and certainly without a GPS. We had to be able to drill a hole through a half a mile of ice, and that hole had to be large enough to allow scientific equipment to pass through it. We also had to battle the full freezing force of the Antarctic ice sheet, which would constantly try to refreeze the hole we had just made. And we had to do all of this without contaminating one of the last remaining pristine environments on Earth. Researchers had been successfully drilling holes to collect ice cores in Antarctica since the 1960s, but their equipment relied on hydrocarbon-based drilling fluids to keep the hole open and keep the drill from freezing into the ice. If those drilling fluids were released into a subglacial lake or accidentally mixed with samples coming out of a lake, it would be akin to an oil spill. It would contaminate the environment with chemicals and release non-native microbial life from the fluid into the lake. To collect samples from subglacial Lake Willens, we would need to do something that had never been done before. Melt snow to generate hot water and use the water as our drill, melting through the entire thickness of the Antarctic ice sheet into the lake below. And our water not only had to be hot, but also had to be filtered and irradiated to remove, damage, or kill any microbial life present in the melted ice we were using to drill the hole. The drill team had arrived in Antarctica at McMurdo Station to begin assembling the drill in October of 2012. A month later, the science team arrived to test the drill. It had to be moved to a slab of ice floating over the sea near the station and assembled there. We made sure that it could melt its way through the ice and that our filtration and irradiation systems worked. But we were still 600 miles away from subglacial Lake Willens, and we had over 1 million pounds of gear, fuel, and laboratories that had to make their way there. The drill alone, with all of its hoses, heaters, and controls, took up 6 shipping containers. This was the largest traverse of scientific equipment in Antarctic history. On a cloudy, windy day, my fellow scientists and I trekked a few miles outside of McMurdo to see our 14 tractors off. The tractors were pulling all of our gear behind them on skis. It was over 1 million pounds of equipment, including our scientific instruments, massive fuel bladders, and laboratories specially designed to fit into shipping containers. We cheered as the first tractors left, but they were only going about 7 miles per hour. So it was really more like celebrating the start of a race between gigantic turtles than anything else. We watched the tractors move closer to the horizon, following the ice road towards the South Pole. We could still see them, brightly colored against the flat white, when we turned to head back to McMurdo. Once our gear reached subglacial Lake Willens, our team would fly in on a plane and camp there while conducting our research. summer in the Antarctic, with its round-the-clock sunlight and comparatively mild weather, only spans a few short months. But it's the only time that fieldwork can happen. The permanent darkness of winter and the extreme cold of spring and fall make the outdoors dangerous for people and wreak havoc on equipment. With the polar night always looming on the horizon, we were making the most of that short window. But from the day the tractors left McMurdo, we had only 35 days to conduct our field operations. After that, the Antarctic winter would force us out. But the convoy of tractors moved slowly. During the first 2 days, the traverse progressed only 76 miles. On the third day, it didn't move at all. Reports came back to us that some of the shipping containers were buckling as they navigated over the cracks and ridges in the bumpy ice. The Antarctic ice is not like the smooth ice of a pond that you skate on. It's dangerous and tough to get through, even for big tractors. The traverse team had to stop and weld the containers back together, and we weren't sure whether they would make it all the way to the lake. A week passed, and the traverse still had 500 miles to go. There were rumors that if they couldn't start moving quickly, our project would be shut down. If they didn't get to Subglacial Lake Willen soon, there wouldn't be enough time for us to get our work done before winter. Finally, the traverse made it across the crevasse transition from the Ross Ice Shelf to the West Antarctic Ice Sheet, and they were able to pick up some speed. After 2 weeks, they parked at Subglacial Lake Willens. The flat white plain of ice was suddenly transformed into a small bustling village of red shipping containers and bright yellow tents, ready for us to move in. And then, in true Antarctic style, the weather turned. High winds buffeted our little village on the ice, and low clouds and blowing snow reduced visibility to the point that none of the ski planes that would carry us there could fly. So we kept waiting and went over and over our plans. We discussed what we could do if we ended up with only 1 day of field science or with only one sample from the lake. We repeatedly stared at our spreadsheets, trying to avoid saying openly what we were all thinking. What if we were rebuffed by the weather and had to return home without knowing what was under that ice? We built a shrine to the lake in our lab, rings of empty incubation flasks staring up at an empty sample bottle, begging it to be filled with lake water. All we needed was a few good days, but we needed them soon. After an excruciating week, the weather finally improved, and we piled into a Basler BT-67 and took the 2-hour flight to the lake. We were 21 days into our 35-day window. We hadn't even started the hard part, drilling the hole, and we still didn't know what we were going to find once we had a hole. Subglacial Lake Willens is what's known as an active subglacial lake, meaning that it periodically drains, spilling most of its water into the nearby ocean. If we inadvertently sampled it right after it drained, there would be no water for us to collect. And while it seemed unlikely that the lake would be sterile, I knew that life in the lake could be so sparse or so starved that detecting it could be incredibly difficult. For 4 days, the drill team worked day and night on melting a hole. This was a massive operation. Instead of using a drill bit, they were slowly reeling a 1/2-mile-long hose, spewing pressurized, nearly boiling water down through the ice. The hose itself spooled along a giant reel suspended about 20 feet above the ice. Keeping the hose from bending or wandering off course was imperative. It hung straight and tight, looking something like a long PVC pipe, inching its way down the hole. As it inched, I organized and reorganized the lab along with the other PhD students, pored over my experimental protocols, and labeled incubation tubes in anticipation of the samples I hoped we would get. Then, 28 days into our 35-day window, a pressure sensor on the drill spiked, a sign that we might have broken through into the lake. We spent a day pulling the hose out of the hole we'd drilled, and then slowly lowering a camera into it. What we saw was a near disaster. The image from the camera was like looking down the double barrel of a shotgun. The drill hose had gotten off track, and the hole had split in two. A double barrel hole meant that even if one hole made it all the way to the lake, we would never know which one it was. An instrument lowered towards the lake could fall into the right hole and make its way through, or fall into the wrong one and become stuck, never finding its way. Years of planning prepared us for these moments, but while you're in it, it feels more like walking a tightrope without a safety net. Science is a constant exercise in patience, and there may be no place in the world more humbling than the Antarctic. Putting the two together leaves a person balanced on their tiptoes, patiently waiting to fall off, but hoping to skip across instead. So while the drill team lowered the hose back down the hole and sat there pumping water into it for hours, trying to get the double barrel to become a single hole, I kept myself busy labeling vials in the lab. A day later, we again thought we'd had a breakthrough. This time, the camera slid easily down a single tunnel of blue ice and clear water, and then into wisps of milk chocolate swirl before gently falling into the fluffy mud of the lake bed. We raised and lowered the camera, finding the bottom of the ice and measuring the depth of the water between it and the lake floor. 3 feet, we estimated. That barely qualified as a pond. It was maybe more like a wetland. But there was water. We started collecting samples on day 30, lowering our gray cylindrical collection bottle down slowly on a winch line. This is not the kind of collection bottle you might picture in a science lab. We're not talking about a small glass vial. Our bottle was more than 3 feet long and 10 inches wide. With its ends propped open in the ready-to-sample position, the bottle was almost as wide as the hole, so we moved slowly to keep from smacking it on the ice and breaking it, or triggering it to close prematurely. The round trip took 3 hours, with one team at the hole in charge of the bottle, and my team in the lab getting ready to receive the sample. When the bottle reached the lake and filled with water, the team sent a metal weight down the hole to trigger the bottle to close. They began hauling the bottle up, and my team waited in the lab, clad in white protective suits to keep parts of us from contaminating the samples. After about an hour and a half, the sample bottle made it back up to the surface. My PhD advisor cradled the bottle and its nearly 3 gallons of precious water, shuffling carefully from the hole to the lab without jostling it or dropping it. When he placed it in its plywood cradle, we sprung into action. One of us attached a carefully cleaned piece of tubing to the spigot on the sample bottle, while the other held another bottle to collect the water. We opened the valve. Nothing came out. We realized the spigot had frozen shut. We worked quickly, using our gloved hands to warm the spigot and gently tap the ice crystals out of it. Water started to flow, finally. It was the color of a weak mug of Earl Grey tea. My colleague quickly took a sample and checked the conductivity of the water. Did the salt content look like melted glacier ice or like something else? We had to be sure we were looking at lake water, not melted ice from the glacier, before we set up our experiments. It was saltier than the glacier, so we knew we had the first sample of liquid water from a subglacial lake. But now was no time to celebrate. It was 6:37 in the morning on January 28th, 2013, and in just 4 days, we had to complete our science, pack up our samples, and pack up our lab, and fly back to McMurdo. Later, After a cup of coffee and a bowl of oatmeal, I turned on the microscope. I held a glass bottle containing a few ounces of subglacial Lake Willens water, which I had fixed with formaldehyde to preserve anything that might be living in the water. It was impossible to tell with the naked eye whether or not some intrepid creature floated in the amber-colored liquid. I added a few drops of yellowish-orange stain and mixed it in the vial. I placed a sample on a slide and put the slide under the microscope. I took a deep breath, finally allowing myself to be nervous. No one had ever accomplished what we just did, and what I was about to look at would answer the question of whether or not life can exist in one of the most remote and unlikely places on Earth. The lab was empty. Everyone had needed a coffee break or some sleep after collecting that first sample. I blinked to let my eyes adjust and peered through the microscope, rotating the fine focus knob. What I saw was a dark field covered in small dots, glowing bright greenish yellow. I could tell right away that they were cells. Their DNA was stained by the yellowish orange dye, and now their microscopic forms fluoresced before my eyes. I started to count them so I could calculate how many lived in the lake. But after seeing a few in different shapes and sizes, I looked away and caught my breath. Only yesterday, those microorganisms had been a half a mile beneath where I now sat. No one had ever looked at them. Who was I to pull them out into the daylight and thrust them under my microscope? I had to share this, not look at them alone. The moment felt like it weighed a ton, and I tried to etch it into my memory because I knew that I might never be a part of something this monumental again. I stood up, turned off the microscope, and pushed open the door of the bright red shipping container that was our lab. I blinked in the bright sunlight and took a deep breath of the cold air. The peaks of the transantarctic mountains barely emerged from the horizon. Everything looked the same as it had yesterday. No one in the world knew yet what I had just seen under the microscope in the red shipping container. No one knew that we had discovered new life. I zipped up my jacket and walked through camp, ice crunching under my boots, ready to let the excitement of discovery waft through the air.
That was Trista Vic Majors. She's a PhD candidate in ecology and environmental sciences at Montana State University, and she spent 5 seasons conducting research on lakes and subglacial environments in Antarctica. We've got photos of her Antarctic fieldwork on our website, outthereshow.com, and you can find a link to the paper that she and her colleagues published about subglacial Lake Willens there as well. It was published in the journal Nature. That's it for this episode of Out There. We'll have a new show the second Thursday of every month. If you like what you heard, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. We're hoping for 5 stars. And consider supporting Out There with a financial contribution. The kinds of stories we bring you take weeks, if not months, to put together, and gifts from listeners like you make this kind of journalism possible. To make a donation in any amount, just go to outthereshow.com and click support. If you've got an idea for a story or interview, or you'd like to submit something you wrote, you can do so on our website as well. You can also follow me on Twitter, @WillowBeldon. Our theme music was written by Jared Arnold, and special thanks to KGLT for helping us with recording Trista's piece. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.